is the U.S. v. Davis. Mr. Patel.
Good morning, Your Honors. In this case, there were three separate Fourth Amendment violations as we laid out in our briefs, but due to time constraints, Your Honor, today I'd like to focus on the third violation, and that's the police's warrantless inclusion and search of Mr. Davis's DNA in a criminal database. In this case, Your Honors, the police took Mr. Davis's clothes when he came in as a shooting victim in a hospital and then years later extracted DNA from those clothes and subsequently placed it in a criminal database, even though at the time of that entry, Mr. Davis was not under arrest for any offense, he was not on parole, he was not on probation, he was not convicted of any offense that would have qualified him to be put into the database under either Maryland or federal law. He was not even a suspect at that time. In fact, he had just been cleared because the police tested his DNA from the Michael Neal homicide scene, and it didn't match. So, Your Honor, because at the time the police forced his DNA into a databank, he was a victim, exoneree, a free person. He had an undiminished expectation that his DNA would remain free from the criminal database, and that's why the district court correctly found that that third search was unreasonable, even though the district court then gravely erred in applying the good faith exception. But before I go to the good faith exception, Your Honor, I think it's absolutely crucial to the analysis here that Mr. Davis was a victim at the time that the police took his clothes. Because he was a victim, he had an undiminished expectation that the police would not then at a later point take his DNA without a warrant and store it into a database to be searched over and over again when he was not under arrest, he was not convicted of anything, he was not on parole, and he wasn't on probation. Your Honor,
how does the concept of attenuation fit in to your analysis?
Your Honor, with respect to
passage of time between the seizure of the clothing and the ultimate placing his DNA into the database.
Well, Your Honor, here I'm saying even if the police had seized the clothes legally, this was an independent violation to then put his DNA into the database. That was an independent violation.
So you're
regardless,
saying standing alone, that would necessitate.
Yes, yes, Your Honor, it would, because the reason why the court has to come to that conclusion is it can't be that because one has the misfortune of being a victim, because the police then is serendipitously come into contact with those clothes, then forevermore that hospital victim has lost his privacy rights in his DNA, and the police can have unfettered access to that information and store that very private genetic information forevermore in a criminal database to be searched again and again. Your Honor, if that was true, then every time a drunk driving victim walked into the hospital, every time a rape victim walked into the hospital, his DNA would be completely up for grabs, and the police can do whatever they want with it, whenever they want with it. And this
Let's assume, and I know the government disagrees, but let's assume for the sake, perhaps, of the balance of your time, that the court agrees with Judge Titus that was a violation. So what? And what I mean by that is,
right,
as you acknowledge, it's the exclusionary remedy that is the real mountain here.
Well, Your Honor,
let me ask you whether it makes any difference in answering Judge Davis. Does it make any difference that the misconduct, if you want to call it that, of putting his DNA into the database occurred well before the activity undertaken to solve the robbery that we have here?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because actually there wasn't that much time.
Well, there were months.
There were 2 months that passed, but it directly was the result of that illegal inclusion. So just the mere passage of time, and we're talking about 2 months, that certainly doesn't attenuate it. The illegality, the fruit, came about as a direct result of the DNA being put illegally into the database. And with that said, Your Honor, here, the good faith exception, to apply it here would be a first. It would be an unwarranted, unprecedented.
The fact pattern in this case is a first.
Pardon me?
So the fact pattern in this case is a first.
Well, Your Honor, if I can address.
No party has cited any case that's remotely like this.
But Your Honor, I think that maybe this particular fact scenario hasn't happened before, but we have to be very careful that the good faith exception doesn't excuse mistakes of law. Because if that was the case, if every time the law was unsettled and the police then made their own erroneous assessment of the law rather than going to the magistrate, why would they go to the magistrate? They'd have every incentive then to make their own erroneous assessment, knowing that they're going to be protected and shielded by the good faith exception.
If I can.
Yeah.
I think there's danger here in talking about the good faith exception. It's clear from my review of the Supreme Court that we have a number of good faith exceptions. I mean, Davis created a new good faith exception. Is it your understanding that Judge Titus either applied or purported to apply a Leon-type exception?
I think that's what Judge Titus was doing.
It's clearly not Leon.
Exactly, Your Honor. It's not Leon. It's not Herring. It's not Krull. All of those are tied by... See, Your Honor, the good faith exception has only been applied by the Supreme Court to prevent the exclusionary rule when the police have reasonably relied on a third party who is at fault. So, for example, Your Honor, in Leon, the police officers, they went to the magistrate who was at fault. In Illinois versus Krull, the police relied on a statute where the legislature explicitly authorized a search. So it was the legislature who was at fault.
What about Herring?
In Herring, Your Honor, it was the police who conducted the search relied on a clerical of another police department. Here we have one police department who committed the independent error of putting the DNA in the database.
What does it make if there's one police department, as long as the police officers were different police officers? There's no allegation here that the same officer set this up.
No, Your Honor, but I think that what Leon says is that the exclusionary rule applies not just to deter individual police officers, but also to deter the bad policies of the police department. And here, Your Honor, what's particularly egregious, too, is that the DNA analyst who put the DNA into the database, she specifically testified that she knew that there was a Maryland statute which said, you know, cleared persons aren't to go into the database. She knew that Mr. Davis had just been cleared because his DNA did not match the DNA taken from the Michael
right,
Neal murder
scene. This doesn't really fit the statute exactly. It certainly fits the spirit of the statute, I guess you could argue, but it doesn't fit the facts of the statute in terms of not being convicted or having a vacation or a reversal on appeal.
And you're absolutely right. It doesn't fit the statute perfectly, but I think as Judge Titus pointed out, certainly intent of the legislature was to keep free persons out of the database. And why it's important to look at the statutes also, Your Honor, in Doe versus Broderick, this court looked to the federal statutes to inform one's expectation of privacy. The court said in that case, at issue was whether or not there was an expectation of privacy in medical records. The court looked to a federal statute, which made it more difficult for the government to access medical records for criminal investigation purposes. And this court said that it was a fitting indication, the statute was, of one's expectation of privacy, and the same thing here. And, Your Honor, here, even if the police were unclear about the law, there were red flags, which should
now,
have...
I'm sorry. The analyst uploaded the profile into CODIS.
The DNA analyst testified about placing the DNA in the criminal database.
Civilian employee...
A PG County police employee, yes, and she was basically a police functionary. She was the police.
And why did she do it? Was she asked what her state of mind was when she did it?
There's nothing about that, Your Honor.
Why is there nothing about that?
I don't know, Your Honor. There's nothing in the what we know is that she did know that these statutes existed.
Right.
We should have called it into question. She did know that he was cleared from the database, and it still went.
What else do we know from her?
What else do we know from her? That's what we know from her.
That's what we know.
Yeah, that's what we know from her. And then we also know that the PG County Police. That they knew that the clothes were taken when Mr. Davis was a victim.
Yeah,
so, Your Honor, I think what's really important about the good faith exception here is that when police are unclear about the law, that's exactly when we want them to go to a magistrate. It's reckless for the police not to go to the magistrate.
Don't we know also from the language of Herring and other cases talking about the purpose of exclusion that we want to deter reckless, willful misconduct by the police, definitely. But I think these cases make pretty clear that it doesn't apply to negligent misconduct by the police.
Well,
so what do you have in this record to show that this is more than mere negligence by the police in entering this?
Well, Your Honor, I think, first of all, Herring, we were talking, that was about a mistake of fact. Right? That was a mistake of fact. This is a mistake of law. So I think it's reckless and it's flagrant when the police
agreed that it didn't violate the actual wording of the statute. That while it may have violated the spirit of the statute, we don't convict people for violating the spirit of the statute. So what evidence do you have here to show that the police conduct in entering the DNA into the database was anything other than negligent?
Well, Your Honor, I think it was reckless because there were red flags here. Again, like I said, they did know about the statute and it should have called into question. And when there's a question, which obviously we're at, if we're at the good faith, you know, if there's been a violation, then there should have been a question in their mind that what we were doing, there's something really odd about this that. And in fact, I think one other thing, Your Honor, that's important here is that when they put the DNA into the database at that point in Maryland only allowed convictions. Like you had to have a conviction, felony conviction, not even arrestees' database could be put into there. So here, she knew he was cleared, you know, of this offense. There were these statutes which really restricted who could go into the database, and so that's...
Wait a minute.
Yes.
What would happen if this data entry person or any of the other police officers, after the ones who took the clothes at the hospital, had gone to one of their training seminars and they had been given the language from Edwards that says... that police officers are normally permitted to seize evidence of crime when it is lawfully encountered. And if they assumed, well, we took the clothes of the victim like we do 25 times a day, every day from the hospital, why would that have been grossly negligent to rely on that general premise?
Again, Your Honor, Edwards is a very different case because that was a case in which...
But we're not dealing with skilled lawyers and judges and someone like Judge Titus who took 60 pages to get through this. You know, they're dealing with these things every day. And as Judge Keenan's questions have indicated, what would convert this from negligence to gross negligence?
Well, Your Honor, I think that whenever there's a mistake of law, right, and the police are not sure about the law, or there should be red flags, which should indicate to them that this is unclear, which there were here, then it is reckless. And the reason why is, Your Honor, there's lots of times where we can disagree, reasonable minds can disagree about what the law is, but that mistake of law then should not invoke the good faith exception, because if that was the case, then every time there's a mistake of law, the police would be excused. That would bring an end to the exclusionary rule. And in fact, Your Honor, the 11th Circuit's decision, which was affirmed by the Supreme Court, there's some really great language that cautions about this. It says, when law enforcement officers rely on precedent to resolve legal questions as to which reasonable minds may differ, the exclusionary rule is well tailored to hold them accountable for their mistakes. It says when the police rely on novel extensions of our precedent, they engage in the sort of legal analysis better reserved to judicial officers whose detached scrutiny is a more reliable safeguard against improper searches than the hurried judgment of a law enforcement officer engaged in the often competitive enterprise of ferreting out crime. And in fact, Justice Sotomayor refers to this in the United States versus Davis case. In that case, she says, look, our case, in that case, the Supreme Court held that there was unequivocal binding precedent, which the police officers relied on, about a search incident to arrest. So obviously, it was the appellate court's fault. But she said, this it would be a different situation if the law was ambiguous. So at best here, the law is ambiguous, if not completely clear. And that's exactly the type of situation in which we want police to go to the to the magistrate.
So your argument comes down to, if he had learned before the robbery murder,
which he,
the defendant, if the defendant had learned before the robbery murder that his profile had been placed in CODIS, he could have gone to the circuit court for Prince George's County and had it removed under Maryland law.
Under the law, yes, definitely, Your Honor.
So your point is that it was an error of law,
yes,
for this analyst to upload his profile into CODIS.
Yes, Your Honor.
And whether it was done negligently or recklessly or grossly negligently, it was an error that the exclusionary rule doesn't
and
forgive.
I think we have to assume that when there's a mistake of law. Otherwise, Your Honor, for example, let's say traffic stops. It's often the case, even this court has done analysis and said, look, that was an illegal traffic stop. Now, reasonable minds could differ as to whether there was really reasonable suspicion or probable cause, as we know from some of the decisions in this court, even recent decisions where there's dissent. But the court didn't go to the good faith exception in those cases. Why not? Because it was a mistake of law in which the officer didn't reasonably rely on a third party. It would set a really dangerous precedent, Your Honor. I don't know of one case where the good faith exception has been applied in a situation where there's not a third party who's at fault. And again, the reason for this is because when there's this mistake of law, when you have police officers are unclear about the law or should be unclear about the law, that's when we want them to go to the magistrate.
So
if we don't.
Yeah, but what you're asking us to do is to say that because it was within the same police department, that makes the difference. Because in Herring, it was a different police department.
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
So that's where the line of accountability gets drawn in your analysis. And what is the constitutional basis for drawing that line in in the good faith exception case?
Well, I think in Herring,
I agree with you. Third party is an important part of the analysis, but why is there a wall that has to be between one police department and another police department?
I don't think there always has to be that wall, Your Honor. I think that sometimes, even if you have another police department, it might be the case that you don't want one police officer to launder illegally information to a different police department. So in that circumstance, there could be circumstances where the exclusionary rule still applies. But I think that there has to be another police department. But in this case, it was the DNA analyst herself, you know, who testified about placing it in the DNA data bank. She should have been held responsible.
Your
because
argument, if the analyst who put the DNA in the data bank was in the first county, I forget whether that was Frederick County, county that was, instead of in Prince George's County, does that affect your argument?
No, Your Honor, because the violation that I'm talking about is the third violation. That's PG County, even if it was legally put into the database, regardless of what Howard County did, the mistake here, the error here, was of the PG County Police Department. It was of the DNA analyst who put Mr. Davis's DNA into the data bank.
But if that analyst was in the first police department, so it was already in there, so all the Prince George's County officer did was just look it up, like he would look up anybody else's.
Well,
so it's another police department, like in Herring, that did that. How does that alter your argument, or does
that, it? That would be different, Your Honor, because then the person doing the search isn't the police officer putting the information into the database is not the police officer conducting the illegal search. See, here, the police officer who is responsible for the mistake was the PG County Police Department officer, Your Honor, who put the DNA into the data bank. So the PG County Police here were responsible. It was not another police department that made a mistake of fact. And also, Your Honor, I think...
Is the extraction in order to create the profile part and parcel of the uploading? Or do you argue that that's a separate Fourth Amendment violation?
Well, that was a separate Fourth Amendment violation. Because
the extraction.
The extraction and the analysis. For example, when they had this unknown level of suspicion that Mr. Davis was involved in the Michael Neal murder, that was extraction and then analysis. But then the third violation occurred because when he was cleared, that's when they put it into the DNA database.
I mean, that's your case right there.
Yeah.
Putting it in the database.
Yeah, because then it was searched, and it resulted in the violation. So, Your Honor,
I think we understand. We've let you go over some, and you've got some time on rebuttal.
Okay, great. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Ms. Johnson, let's hear your side of it.
Good morning, Your Honor. Ms. Glatfelter, my co-counsel, and I are here before the court because the defense has asked the court to rule that Detective Blazer's seizure of Mr. Davis's known DNA sample pursuant to a search warrant should be excluded and ask the court to apply the exclusionary rule. In this instance,
I don't think that's what they're asking for.
He's going back a little bit farther in time than that.
I appreciate he's going back further than that. What he seeks to do is argue that because of this earlier placing of the DNA into the database, in his opinion and in the opinion of Judge Davis, was some violation of Mr. Davis's privacy. You mean
Judge Titus?
I'm sorry.
I haven't ruled yet.
Judge Titus. That putting that into the search warrant, that ultimately the known sample was the fruit of this illegal search earlier. What was introduced at trial in this case was the known DNA sample, the known DNA profile of Mr. Davis that was obtained one time, and that known sample was obtained one time pursuant to the search warrant that Detective Blazer prepared, and in that search warrant he told the district court, I believe it was a district court, no, circuit court judge in Prince George's County, that they had run evidence from the crime scene and that evidence matched DNA.
Sorry, Ms. Johnson, let me make sure I'm following. Mm-hmm. The sole probable cause to get the known sample by warrant was the CODIS hit. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. It was the CODIS hit on...
That was the sole basis for probable cause in the warrant that permitted them to obtain the known sample. I think you're saying yes, that's correct.
Your Honor, it was the CODIS... What was presented in the affidavit was the CODIS hit of clothing obtained from an incident with Mr. Davis.
No, it was the CODIS hit on DNA profile. Doesn't matter. I mean, we don't need to talk about the clothing, I don't think. I mean, we can if you want to, but that's a separate issue. But the sole basis for probable cause for that warrant was the CODIS hit.
Was the CODIS hit.
So in order for us to determine whether the Leon exception applies, we have to first go behind the warrant, don't we?
Your Honor, we have to the court should look at the warrant and
the only support for the warrant was the CODIS hit.
Yes,
and if
Your
the
Honor.
CODIS profile is tainted by an antecedent Fourth Amendment violation, I don't think we even get to Leon.
Well, I think you do get to Leon because the issue...
How do we get to Leon if... Is there any case in which the sole basis for probable cause for a warrant that might otherwise be analyzed under Leon, if the sole basis for that probable cause is itself tainted support, how do you even get to Leon?
Your Honor, the question is should the exclusionary rule apply? And here, when we talk about the CODIS hit in this case, I think it's important to distinguish, one, it was not a CODIS hit on the defendant's known profile. As is set forth in the search warrant affidavit, it was a CODIS hit on an item of evidence that was recovered in an incident involving Mr. Davis.
It was his profile.
It was...
I don't understand. You know, I don't want to take up your time.
You know, this... And I don't mean to interject...
Go ahead,
Judge Davis is saying, but, you know, this is just so important. This is, as Judge Agee said, a really unusual case. And to have the government standing on the fact that the actual profile was not part of the warrant really doesn't help us at all. It looks like you're standing... you're avoiding the argument or avoiding the analysis. So I don't think it's...
Your Honor, I'm absolutely not avoiding the argument in this case because I think it's clear under the Supreme Court cases recently in Herring and in Davis is that before a district court applies the exclusionary rule, the district court is required to engage in an analysis of the police conduct in that case. And if
what are you saying we... I'm sorry.
Yes. Which Judge Titus did in this case, but what I've gleaned from your argument so far, which may be incorrect, is that essentially it's irrelevant how the DNA got into the CODIS databank. It doesn't matter what happened before that point. And you're going to have to address, you can say, yeah, that's correct, that's what the government's position is. If it's not, then you need to distinguish that.
Your Honor, it is the government's position here. One is that if we look at the conduct of the police officer that applied for that, made the application for the search warrant, that he acted in objectively reasonable
reliance. I'm sorry, please talk about the analyst who uploaded the profile.
The analyst.
That's what this case largely is going to turn on.
Your Honor, the analyst who uploaded that profile uploaded the profile from that piece of evidence that she was given to analyze. She had no information other than she was asked to compare it with another item, which she did, and then pursuant to their policy, she took the DNA profile from that piece of evidence and uploaded it into their system.
Okay, thank you. Now, what was the policy? That every analyzed sample goes into CODIS.
The policy at that time was that every piece of evidence that was analyzed goes into their local CODIS database.
No matter where it came from.
Which is what she did.
No matter where it came
from. No matter where it came from.
No matter how it was obtained.
No matter how it was obtained, because she wouldn't know how it was obtained. All she would know is she might know if it's a known sample, because it would say it's a known sample. If it's a piece of evidence, it would say it's a piece of evidence recovered.
The policy contemplated that tainted DNA profiles would go into the local CODIS.
The policy contemplated that DNA seized from physical items of evidence, would go into the local DNA database.
And everybody knows that from time to time, despite best efforts, mm-hmm. police officers sometimes make mistakes. Sometimes very serious mistakes, like shooting people when they shouldn't, but sometimes less serious mistakes. And so the policy, I think what you're bound to concede here, is that the policy, if she acted pursuant to that policy contemplated as a matter of law, if the policy was, as you say, that every sample goes into the local database, it clearly contemplated that there would be some samples that would come into the possession of the Prince George's County Police Department that would be tainted by antecedent constitutional violations. There would be illegal arrests. There would be illegal searches. And some of those are going to result in a DNA profile. And your argument to us is that under that policy, everything goes up to CODIS.
Now, everything doesn't go up to CODIS. Everything is in the local CODIS
database. We're using CODIS. I understand. We're talking about local CODIS.
I can only
government database.
I can only tell you that, as I think we included in the supplemental joint appendix, that the chemist testified, the analyst testified that once they completed an analysis, that was placed into the local database.
Didn't matter where it came from.
She would not know other than that it's a piece of evidence, and she would not know the circumstances.
And under the policy, she didn't need to know.
She would have no basis of knowing.
She would have no reason to know.
She would have
The policy says every profile goes to the CODIS.
The policy tells practice there. I can't say there's a written policy, but it was a practice there, and according to her testimony, that once they completed the analysis of an item of evidence, or it was placed into that local database.
Are you saying that it was a mistake of law on her part?
No, I'm not saying there was a mistake of law on her part. What I'm saying is...
What was it?
Her loading in that profile was not a violation of anyone's of rights. The DNA that was loaded into that database, we can assume, Judge Titus assumed that it was a violation of Mr. Davis's privacy rights.
Why wasn't it a violation?
Of his privacy rights, because what was loaded into the DNA database is not his entire DNA. What's loaded into the database is the identifying portion of his DNA that does nothing more than act as a biological fingerprint of the defendant. It is what's commonly referred to as junk DNA. It contains no personal information about him. It doesn't contain any of his physical characteristics. It doesn't show any kind of medical predisposition to any medical illnesses. It has none of the privacy implications that you might have in the medical records of a patient, because that's not what's on it. What's on it is the identifying features, just like a fingerprint, and nothing more.
The facts a little bit to try to get at a principle. Mm-hmm. So in this case, instead of the clothes being taken at the hospital, the police in the first jurisdiction think that Mr. Davis is a suspect in some crime there, and so they really want to get his DNA. So when he leaves the hospital, they grab him in the parking lot, and they forcefully take a DNA sample, and it goes into the data bank, and lo and behold, he's not the one that committed the crime they were looking at. So it's still in the data bank. And then the facts go on the same way they were in this case. And the Prince George's officers, no knowledge of how this DNA was entered, get the hit later on. How's that different in principle from what you're arguing in this case?
Yeah, I believe your analysis would be the same. The analysis would be the same in terms of application of the exclusionary rule, because you would have to look at where is the misconduct, or the unlawful conduct, and would excluding the evidence deter that misconduct? In this case, we don't have any blatant misconduct as you have in that case where they forcibly take the DNA. In the case where they forcibly take the DNA, then one would argue that's the misconduct. It's placed in the DNA system. Now the question becomes is whether or not excluding the evidence in the Prince George's County case would have a significant deterrent impact on the prior unconstitutional conduct.
And that hypothetical goes to... hypothetical, it's more than reckless or grossly negligent. So you have to deter that. But in this case, it's not.
In this case, we have no evidence that anyone did anything deliberate or reckless. I think that is a distinction that could be drawn. We would also, that makes it more difficult there, because clearly you have police misconduct. In this case, we don't have any police misconduct leading up to placing the DNA into that database. So what we're being asked, what the court's being asked to do is say that the entry of that DNA profile from a piece of clothing that could be linked to Mr. Davis was a violation of his rights, and that act was reckless, grossly reckless, deliberate. Deliberate.
How can it not be not only reckless, how can it not be intentional if the policy of the county police department is to upload every profile regardless of the source of the biological material from which that profile is derived? How can it be anything other than intentional?
It's the act of loading it would be intentional, but it was not done deliberately in terms of doing something that would violate someone's...
Deliberate if the policy is no matter where we get profiles from, they all go into CODIS. I'm sorry, Ms. Johnson. I'm really struggling with this.
Like a classic case for deterrence. And see, that's what's troubling me here. Well, if you have a practice that we're not going to even care whose DNA this is. If we've got the analysis, we're going to put it in. That's what's really worrying me about this.
Judge Keenan, that happens every day with evidence seized from a crime scene. The police department doesn't know whose DNA it is. They may have some suspicions, but they enter crime scene evidence into the DNA database all of the time.
And presumably, crime scene evidence is lawfully seized. It's either seized in plain view or pursuant to a warrant or pursuant to consent or pursuant to any number of other pathways to the legal seizure of that evidence.
And our point in this case is that the DNA that was loaded into the DNA database was seized lawfully.
Okay,
because
so
it was seized.
The seizure of the clothing
was lawful.
Was lawful, and anything they wanted to do with that clothing or the biological material left on that clothing was lawful.
Yes, because
and what warrant exception is there?
That
the plain view?
The clothing was lawfully seized pursuant to the plain view exception.
And what about the opening of the bag in order to retrieve the clothing? Is that not a separate search?
In our view, it was not a separate search. They seized the clothing. They took it into police custody. It remained in police custody for 44 months. Once it was lawfully in police custody, the police, whether it be this police department or another police department, is entitled to seize it. You have
an automobile accident involving a drunk driver. Mm-hmm. Police officer can come along and seize anything and everything he or she wants. And if there's biological material, can put all that in the CODIS database. I mean, it's a potential crime scene, right? A collision between two vehicles involving a suspected drunk driver.
I don't believe that the clothing in that case would be relevant to the crime.
But you didn't say anything about relevance previously.
Why
does it have to be relevant to the crime?
Well, in order to seize items in plain view, you have to satisfy the plain view requirement. And I think you'd have trouble in a car accident satisfying that if you were taking a injured party's clothing. In this instance, we had a shooting, which was evidence of a crime. And so there was a basis to seize the clothing, as Judge Titus found.
So you think Judge Titus got it partially right, but then sort of went off in the wrong direction when he concluded that uploading was a bridge too far?
I think that it's a very difficult issue for all of us when we're talking about what's in a DNA database. One thing we have to remember is what's being put in that DNA database is not...
We all understand
the science of it.
Although, of course, recent reports show that junk DNA is not really junk DNA. I mean, obviously the science is evolving. Mm-hmm. We're not sure of those 13 loci whatsoever.
We may get to that point, but once they had it in their custody lawfully as evidence of a crime, was in police custody for 44 months, and then it was tested and put into the the system. What right of privacy did Mr. Davis have at that point in time to those clothing that had been with the police for all of these 44 months that were lawfully seized? We're not talking about a profile that was taken from him personally, where, as in, you know, a felon or somebody who's been arrested illegally and their profile's taken from him. This profile was obtained from a piece of clothing that was lawfully taken to him pursuant to the plain view doctrine. In addition to that, he was arrested at the time and taken into police custody at that time, which also, in all likelihood, would have resulted in the seizure of those clothing then. So,
let me ask you a question on this plain view analysis, mm-hmm. if I could. I don't mean to interrupt, but it seems that you've kind of glossed over the fact that the evidence has to have some incriminatory character, doesn't it, in order to be seized under plain view? And I remember Judge Titus, I think, said in his opinion it has to incriminate someone, not necessarily the person whose clothes were being right. seized. Isn't this evidence that was just potentially incriminating that was seized? And generally, the police see the gun in the car, they see the, mm-hmm. you know, the drugs or the paraphernalia or something that clearly makes it mm-hmm. incriminatory. Right. We don't really have that. So how do you get beyond that here?
Well, we have the clothing that was seized was clothing that
potentially
would be
incriminatory of someone.
Well, you don't always know that it's going to be incriminatory as to someone else. If you seize a shell casing from in plain view, you seize a shell casing because you know that the gun was discharged.
Well, you're seizing that as evidence of a crime at a crime scene. You aren't seizing it as under the plain view doctrine, are you?
You might if you stop somebody and you see a shell casing in their car and you seize it because it's the same caliber. You know, you could match it up to something. I think in this case is the pants themselves are incriminated because they have a bullet hole in them.
They could be.
Well, you don't know until you have the rest of the evidence.
Let me ask you what really is my bigger mm-hmm. problem here, and that is the whole concept of deterrence and the fact that this was the routine practice of the Prince George's Police Department to enter this data. Herring talks about different kinds of conduct. It talks about reckless conduct and grossly negligent conduct. It also talks about systemic mm-hmm. conduct. Why isn't this systemic conduct that falls within the ambit of deterrence for purposes of the exclusionary rule?
Because we don't have evidence here that what Prince George's County, the police department's putting in there is a history of putting in their illegally obtained DNA. We don't have evidence before the court, and defendant didn't attempt to put on evidence to show that there was a systemic problem here. Albeit they put in all of the evidence that they analyze into the system, but there's no indication that the evidence that they're putting into their database, I think it was 900 or 950 that they had in there, that a large percentage of those were illegally seized.
So you're saying there would have to be evidence independent of this case to show systemic, not just simply a uniform policy, but that uniformly there were free citizens, so-called, who had their genetic code put in by the police department.
I think that is correct. That you need to have some evidence that there was something that was done continually. For example, in the Herring case, you would have had evidence that they had routinely left the warrants in the database after they had been withdrawn. There isn't evidence here of that nature. These facts are rather unique in that it was a piece of evidence that was put in there that ended up matching the evidence from this crime scene. That can happen repeatedly. If you think about it, if somebody is involved in a shooting and some clothing are seized and their blood or a fight and their blood isn't on it as a victim or as a perpetrator and that's put or as a victim and it's put in the system and they're involved in another fight someplace else where they're actually the perpetrator, there would be a match between those two crime scenes.
You've answered.
I apologize, Your Honor.
That's perfectly okay. All right, Mr. Patel, you've got some rebuttal time.
Your Honor, one thing I would like to do is point the court to testimony that makes it very clear that the DNA analyst we were talking about wasn't some clerical employee. She was a police officer who did know how the DNA was retrieved and how it got into the database. First of all, with respect to the statute, she was aware, again, that there was
she
some...
Did she know how the defendant's DNA was collected in this case?
That was asked of her, and I'm going to walk you through it, counsel. First of all, says... here's the questioning. Do you have knowledge of where those boxes originated from?
Tell us where you are.
And I'm on SJA 93. This is Supplemental Joint Appendix 93. It says, do you have knowledge of where those boxes originated from that were tested by you in your laboratory? Then there's objection, relevance. Finally, she says, my only awareness is what I was told by the detective in the case. Then the defense attorney asks, what were you told by the detective? That they were taken from a hospital emergency room where he had been brought in, I believe, for a shooting. In your testing, you ultimately excluded the profile you developed from those boxers to that which you were asked to compare it to from this unsolved homicide, correct? That's correct. In fact, the DNA was not a match. That's correct. He was excluded as not being the source of the DNA in question, correct? Correct. After he was excluded, at what point did you or someone from your lab put Mr. Davis's DNA profile from that testing into the local DNA database? Do you know when that happened? I can check my notes. Actually, I do know this. It was within about a week of completion that the sample was put into the database. Even beyond that, again, this goes to recklessness, Judge Keenan. They were aware that there were statutes out there. She was personally aware. That there was a statute out there which should have called into question putting in a free person's DNA into the database. She was asked, now, you are also aware within the Maryland level of the DNA database that the person, you have to delete profile if the court orders expungement because a conviction has been vacated that was the predicate for them being put into the felon DNA database, correct? She said, yes. Presumably, because if they are no longer having the predicate conviction, then they should be allowed to take it out pursuant to statute, correct? Yes, there was recklessness here, Your Honor. The DNA analyst was a PG County police officer. Not only do we have this policy that is dangerous policy, but we have the specific person who did the illegal search. She knows how it got into the database. She knows that Mr. Davis was a victim when he came into that hospital. She knows, she knew that he was cleared when his DNA did not match the DNA from the crime scene, yet the DNA still went into the database. That is reckless, Your Honor.
Do you agree with Ms. Johnson that you don't have a systemic situation, that you haven't established systemic abuse without showing that other people similarly situated or that other defendants actually were treated in this manner, apart from the fact that they routinely did it?
But Your Honor, I don't believe there's evidence of like this reoccurring, but in Herring also, it doesn't say that you have to show this reckless, but if there's... that's behavior that should be deterred. If there's reckless behavior, it says...
What you're saying is that the recklessness is an independent
yes.
behavior that you can show systemic.
Yes.
You might not have it here, but that you have reckless.
Yeah, and if you read Herring, Your Honor, actually the court is very clear. It says reckless behavior or systemic negligence. So,
right, but I had understood from your prior argument that you were saying this was systemic as well.
Yeah, there's a danger here that it could be systemic, particularly because there's this policy of putting everybody's DNA into the database, Your Honor. So thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the panel, I'd like to thank both counsel. It's a difficult case, and we appreciate the effort and the argument here. We'll come down.